welcome to the historical podcast of the University of Bern. Today, a talk with Professor Christian Rohr on the topic At the Summit, Mountains, Plains, and the Challenges of Environmental History. My name is Philip Horn, and we hope you enjoy this podcast. We could start this podcast with the usual warnings. Warnings of what will happen with our planet if we do not finally take action against climate change. But if you're honest, it seems that we are finally paying the price for what we have done to the planet in the past. As summer is approaching, eco-anxiety is rising, and the devastating impacts of the man-made climate catastrophe are omnipresent. From New York City's skyline, covered in orange smoke, to melting glaciers or the recent breaking of mountain summits at the Swiss border. I will talk about summits and the current challenges of environmental history with our today's guest, Christian Rohr, who is professor for environmental history at the University of Bern. Christian Rohr is also one of the organizers of the 12th Conference of the European Society of Environmental History that will take place at the University of Bern this year from 22nd to 26th of August. Thanks for being here today, Mr. Rohr.
Hello.
Yeah, we have designed our today's episode with regard to this conference, which is, by the way, the reason why we are having our conversation in English today. The conference theme has been chosen in connection to Bern's closeness to the Alps. Mountains and plains, past, present and future environmental and climatic entanglements is its title. What are the main objectives of the conference?
Yeah, let me maybe start with a short introduction into the conferences of the environmental history societies and in general of the ESEH here in Europe. This was a society founded around 2000, and from 2001 we had a conference every second year on different places, so it moves from one place to the next. And the conference topics are always related to the main focuses of research and also to the landscape surrounding this conference venue. So this is the first time that the ESEH conference comes to Switzerland and to Bern at the university. We have a long tradition of environmental and climatic research, and therefore it was a very pleasant idea to apply for this conference. And so we are happy now that we will host this conference in late August 2023. Maybe just some remarks on the topic. When dealing with the Alps, this is not only a topic related to the Alps itself, but mountains in general have always to be seen just in interconnection, in the entanglement with the surrounding areas. So, for instance, if you look at traffic, people from the plains in Germany and the plains in Italy have to surmount the mountains since thousands of years, from Ötzi to the medieval merchants up to now, to the tourists going to Italy from Germany and so on and so on. On the other hand, for instance, water is one of the most important resources, and Switzerland or the Alps in general are something like the water castle of Europe, and anything related to water supply is connected to the Alps and to mountains in general. So in any case, these interconnections are very important from an environmental point of view. But also, if you look at local, regional and global climate, mountainous areas have a strong influence in climatic developments, and therefore looking back to historical societies and also to today and to the future challenges, this is something where we can learn a lot if we look at this topic very closely and from an interdisciplinary perspective.
If we are talking about future challenges, there is another discipline that actually deals a lot with climate change, and that is the natural sciences. What enables climate historians to deal with topics that have been the subject area of natural sciences alone for a long time, and what can historians contribute to the study of climate change?
If we look at climate history and climate change and all the research connected with that, we can see today that this is a merely interdisciplinary field of research. So in former decades, maybe the natural sciences were the only or at least dominating approach to those topics, but since 20, 30 years, and also due to quite a lot of researchers being active here in Bern, it has been shown that sources from anthropogenic sources like chronicles, like any reports, weather diaries, and so on and so on, they are very important to contribute to the history of climate and to the reconstruction. Because if you compare it to archives of nature like tree rings and the other archives of nature, you can see that this is only relevant for some seasons in the year, or it is only relevant for some areas where we can apply this method. And if we take the sources also made by humans, we get quite a lot of information on adaptation strategies. We get lots on the details, how all those extremes, very dry years, very humid years, and so on, how they affected the humans during that time. And so the resolution of sources is much better than for any of those sources deriving from archives of nature. And anthropogenic sources are important as well. And so the Oeschger Center for Climate Change Research, which is one of the two organizers of this conference, has built up a tradition to work together from different disciplines, from the humanities, from the social sciences, and of course from the natural sciences. And what is typical for the Oeschger Center is that any of those disciplines are at the equal level, so any interdisciplinary cooperation has been fostered by establishing the center, and therefore I think this model from Bern can also serve as a pattern how to do climate studies in the future.
Following up on what you just said about the archives of nature and the archives of or human archives, is there something like an archive of mountains on the intersection between nature archives and human archives?
If we consider our environment as something like a social natural site, which is an approach developed at the University of Vienna by several renowned scholars there, we always have to consider any of those landscapes as places where natural and social interventions just come together. If you take, for instance, a floodplain along a river, it's not just the river causing, for instance, floods, but it is just also the humans using this river, maybe cutting the fluvial forests or using the water power for mills and so on and so on. And this is also true for the mountains in general, because settlements go higher up in the Alps in the late Middle Ages by, for instance, the Walser communities. And there you have an evidence for their spreading both from archives of nature and human archives. And in many cases, they are connected and they are very specific for the mountains. But still, we can use this concept of social natural sites in any place, not only on the Alps. And therefore, environmental history is aware of combining those two approaches of their sources and how landscapes were shaped. And so I would say that mountains have a very specific setting of sources, both natural and human-made. But on the other hand, we can do that also for plains. We could do that for maritime settings. We could do that for deserts and so on and so on.
Landscapes were changed by humans, but also the planet as a whole. Historians have coined a term for a new era related to man-made climate change, the so-called Anthropocene. What is the Anthropocene in your opinion, and what is the concept? Why is the concept relevant for your conference?
The Anthropocene was a concept just introduced by Nobel Prize winner Paul Crutzen and others, who just stated that humans have influenced global environments so extensively since the beginning of industrialization, but particularly during the 20th century, that this will remain in the Earth's history. That means not only that we have a climate change going on faster and faster compared to other climate changes in the past, but also, for instance, plastic in the sea, in the soil, any extraction of resources and so on. So we can really see that the humans have changed the global environment so tremendously that this is not something that could recover within some decades or centuries, but this is a remaining process, and therefore this could be a new age in Earth history. So this is the concept. And of course, looking at mountains and plains from the past, the present, and the future, we have to consider all these concepts, because whatever we do today is influenced by what has happened in the past. So we are not people without the past, and therefore looking back is very important to understand our today's challenges and also the future challenges, and to have answers or at least some suggestions how to go on in the future. This is also one of the main tasks of our conference.
Regarding the Anthropocene, the historian Alfred W. Crosby once said that for millennia, humans thought themselves as prisoners of nature. Today, this situation has turned, apparently. When in history did nature become the prisoner of mankind, and why?
I'm not very convinced that people had been the prisoners of nature in that sense. Of course, they were dependent from their environment, so this is clear. And they are, in many cases, people in the past were in many cases the weaker part. In this way, prisoners of nature might be a bit exaggerated, but still the direction is correct. On the other hand, this has turned, I think, not by a specific date, but by a long-lasting process. So, for instance, if we look back to early industrialized settings, for instance, in 500 years ago, when gold and silver mining became a really big task in Europe and then in the New World, many of those areas were completely changed, and manpower was the one changing really mountains so that they even collapsed. So in this way, there might be a beginning around 1500 or the like, and then with industrialization, with bigger and bigger machines powered by steam, this might have changed the overall situation, how to deal with the environment. However, we still know that the environment has their strong parts as well, and so it is, at least from a Western perspective, in some kind something like a battle. But this dualism between nature and humans is a very Western concept. So what we are discussing right now is maybe applicable for a European-influenced world, but wouldn't it be the same for any indigenous cultures in other areas, on other continents? So in this way, prisoners of nature or prisoners of mankind is also a question of this concept of dualism between humans and nature, as we have seen that for many, many centuries in the Western world.
Because you just mentioned it, how will the conference engage with the Eurocentrism of environmental history?
On the one hand, when just organizing a conference, we have to be aware of environmental issues like traveling not too much. On the other hand, such a big conference is a big meeting place, like a big market for a global society, just looking at the environmental issues. So we have quite a lot of speakers from many other areas in the world, from South Asia, from the Americas, and so less from Africa, but on the other hand, even some from New Zealand. And they will bring in also different views, because some of them are natives from their area, and they can just bring in discussion in the discussions all those perspectives. On the other hand, we have a format called Different World Sessions, which is also open to any possibility how to deal with those topics. That could be an artistic approach, that could be really experimental. So from last generation climate activists from Europe to approaches from indigenous cultures. But of course, we have to admit that 80% of our participants are from Europe and from North America. So in this way, this is still something where we have to be aware not to be too Eurocentric.
Does Eurocentrism and the idea of the nature as an opponent of mankind is one thing. Another thing is that many of these actual problems are also rooted in a historically grown idea of masculinity. Clara New Daggett from Virginia Tech has coined the term petromasculinity, the idea that the exploitation of fossil fuel and socially constructed masculinity are two related phenomena. To what extent do we have to speak of a historically grown mountain masculinity? A masculinity, an idea of manhood that intersects with misogyny, racism, and colonialism?
Let's say if you look at traditional historical research, I would admit this is correct. But on the other hand, there are quite some counter initiatives also to look at the other side, also to the female conquest of the Alps. For instance, we are working together with Swiss Alpine Museum. We have a mini workshop there. We just will have a more didactic look at their current exhibitions. And there's one exhibition on women on the mountains. So this is something which would show that those mountain climbers, these mostly British sportsmen of the 19th century, being very masculine and very competitive in this sense, this can be countered by another narrative, but these narratives are still to build up. This is the one thing. The other thing is racism, colonialism. Yes, if we look at the conquest of mountains in different areas of the world, there is still quite a lot of colonialism. For instance, if you look at the naming of mountain ridges as Alps. So this is really colonial. But on the other hand, there are also trends, and this is, for instance, researched by Finn Holm, a former postdoc here at the University of Bern, who is now a professor in Tübingen. He looks at concepts of the Alps from a Japanese side. And if you look there, it was the Japanese just emulating the Swiss Alps. So they sent their mountain guides for education to Switzerland and so on. And so that was not a European colonial direction, but it was something coming from the Japanese side for the so-called Japanese Alps.
Almost like a kind of appropriation of...
Something like that. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that colonialism isn't the dominant narrative, but still we have to differentiate when looking at those developments in the past and maybe also in the future. So in this way, this might be in some cases also an appropriation coming from the other side. So mm-hmm. If you look at the Chinese, they were so fascinated by the village of Hallstatt in the Swiss Salzkammergut. Mm-hmm. And they built up a complete copy of this village, which made Hallstatt so popular that now we have a problem of over-tourism in Hallstatt because so many Chinese are coming there. The Alps have a really fascinating feature, and therefore I think the Alps are still a very important place for tourism also for the future. A potential and a challenge, of course.
A challenge too, yes. Speaking of which, one roundtable will be on the relation between environmental history and public policy. What are the challenges and chances of the relation between research and policymaking?
When looking at topics like climate change and also other environmental topics, we have experienced in the past that most of the scientists, be it from the natural sciences, be it from the humanities or social sciences, did not get used to the rules of media, how this works, how can you transport your message. This has only changed during the last years, and we will foster this topic with some of the really stakeholders in global climate and environmental discourse. For instance, we have a member of the United Nations Development Programme. We have other renowned scholars from Switzerland, from other areas in the world, and they will discuss how to best practice transfer from science to policy making. If you look, for instance, at the IPCC reports, there is a report of 1,500 pages, and then there is a summary of 40 pages, and then there's a short statement for the politicians and for the media, which has maybe 2 pages. And this is the big challenge for us, to have the same content, but shaped for different audiences and for different groups. And we are still in the beginning with that. And environmental historians, they might be asked, because they are dealing with environmental issues and people could contact them and so on. And we would like to give them answers. How could stakeholders from politics, from administration, deal with their ideas? How can they bring in themselves and so on? So we have one plenary panel on that. We have small workshops on that. We have several sessions on that. And we hope that people can take some ideas with them how to proceed in the future. And the problem, of course, is if you act or speak as a scientist, you would say, okay, this is not black or white. You have to differentiate. And if you say to let's say, a journalist, it's more complicated than the people might think, many of the journalists will not be interested in your differentiation any longer. So they want the alarmists, or they want the ones saying, oh, nothing happens, we don't have to care about climate change. So communication science is becoming more and more important for us, and that's what we would like to bring in, to have a program which is really according to this overall topic. It's past, present and future entanglements.
Climate change deniers and right-wing politicians are increasingly using historical arguments to undermine scientific evidence and to undermine this scientific communication towards a broader public. The Swiss conspiracy theorist and right-wing MP Roger Köppel, for example, recently said that, I quote, already Hannibal crossed the Alps without spikes, so basically he's implying melting glaciers can't be that bad. How can environmental history defend itself against such attacks or appropriation of arguments?
I think that's really one of the most challenging problems we have at that time, because one of the main methods of those people is cherry picking. That means I do not take the whole study, but I take maybe one sentence. And this sentence, just taken out of the context, might suggest something very, very different. Mm-hmm. And that's what we cannot fight against, because they pick the cherries what they want. And therefore, if we just try to differentiate, this is just our scientific practice. And maybe in some case, we do not consent in all of the things just on climate change. But the climate deniers come, oh, there are some concerns, something is not that clear as they might declare, and then you have this cherry picking. Mm-hmm. So this is one thing where we have to live with those attacks. That's the one thing. The other thing is the problem that many of those people live in their own bubbles today. So if you just search for this and that, and this is not only on climate change, it's also on COVID, it's on many, many other topics, the algorithms of the search engines will know very quickly what you are looking for and what is your framework. And therefore, just reaching those bubbles, this is really a big problem. And maybe what we have learned from climate change discourse, what we have learned from COVID discourse, is that at least some percent of society we cannot reach any longer with arguments. And that was also something we saw just during this yesterday's topic on the initiative on climate protection and climate change that some people...
May I just interrupt you here just to explain that for the audience? Because yesterday, the 18th of June 2023, a clear majority of the Swiss voted in favor of a new climate protection law. And the objective of the law is to make Switzerland climate neutral by 2050. But still, there were 40%, roughly 40%, who voted, 41% who voted against it. And you think that we can't reach these people anymore? Like 40%, that's a lot.
I would not say that we cannot reach those 40%, but roughly saying 10% you cannot reach at all. So and the rest of the 30%, they have to be convinced that doing now something against climate change is also in favor for them and for the children, and that the living conditions will not deteriorate, will not be worse just due to that. And maybe this takes more time, and some people maybe just voted against this law because they thought, oh, then we have all those higher prices for energy and we have to give up our SUV and so on. But still, people have to change in this one or the other way, but we have to convince them that it is not something they will lose, but they will get some new quality. And also compared to what would happen if we didn't anything against climate change.
The denial of climate change seems to be a recent phenomenon, but it is not, as you have told me in the preparation of our today's interview.
Indeed, there are quite a lot of parallels in how climate deniers just are acting. If we look at one of the most influential books in the history of science from the last years, it is written by Harvard professor Naomi Oreskes, and it's entitled Merchants of Doubt. And she looked at the climate skepticists and found out that there is a very close connection to the discussion on tobacco smoke, on the ozone hole, on acid rain. And it comes from think tanks, conservative think tanks in the United States that were mostly sponsored by big oil companies. And they just invented, if you want to call it like that, to seed doubt. So whenever talking about this and that, on the one hand, they just reject it. No, that's not true. And then finally, the evidence is so strong, and then they cannot reject it totally. But what they do is just saying, we cannot be sure that this is really like that. And the way how scientists dealt with tobacco smoke in the 1960s, 1970s, they knew that it might cause cancer and so on and so on. And on the other hand, looking at acid rain on the ozone hole, it was again the same strategy against. So saying, for instance, okay, there are different opinions and therefore we cannot be for sure. And they try to influence, for instance, the talk shows in the United States. And if there is one member of the 95% scientists who are in favor that climate change is really happening, and on the other hand, you have another member from climate deniers, for the spectators, it looks like a 50-50 battle. But in fact, it is not. And this is a strategy which has been invented about 50 years ago, which has been adapted to different topics. And this is not something new. And if you look now at discourses on COVID, discourses also on the war in Ukraine, it is always a very similar strategies of people just trying to undermine the arguments of a very large majority, like the climate scientists working on climate change and showing how this will develop or is very likely developing in the future.
What other challenges are there for climate historians?
I think one of the big issues when dealing with climate change is that it is quite an abstract development. So how do you see, how do you feel climate change? Of course, you can say statistics, 18 of the 20 warmest years of the last millennium were in the last 20 years. This is not just by coincidence, this is just a clear trend. But still, this remains quite distant to the living conditions of people in Switzerland or in many other areas. But if you look at, for instance, the glaciers, you can see how they retreat, how they shrink. And we need to show how these consequences of climate change will influence our living conditions. And on the other hand, how our successes against this climate change can be visualized.
Is there success?
Let's say not for climate change in general, but if we act just in a combination of technical innovation, this is on the one hand, on the other hand, just changing our attitudes of living, then we can really act and we can really change our environment to a better one. And I think just showing that, or also, for instance, the question, are we capable to do this energy transition from nuclear power and from coal and from fossil fuels to solar power to wind energy and other new energy types? We have to show, yes, we can. For instance, looking at history of mobility. 100 years ago, Switzerland had a big problem that was that the railways, which were mostly powered by coal, they didn't get coal any longer or not enough coal during World War I. And this was one of the reasons why to change to electricity. They built the big water power plants in the Alps, and within just 10 years, 50% of the Swiss railways were electrified. So you can change from a fossil fuel cars to electric cars, and you can just adapt the environment for that. And this was something which was contested during the climate initiative now. So I think showing from the past that there have been already successful stories, I think this is also something we have to introduce into this discussion.
And this is then also something where climate historians come into it, because like visualizing this change, because that's an argument of the deniers, that they say this is not possible in such a short time. But you say it is possible, and history shows that apparently it's possible to change within a short frame of time.
And that's why historians are needed for also future challenges. So because they can show this is something which worked in the past, or this is what didn't work in the past. And we have to discuss again, is it important to prohibit this or that? Today, politics quite cautious in prohibiting this or that, because that could just affect the liberty of action and so on, and which is very important, in particular in Switzerland, even more than in other European countries. Yeah. And we have to see that some of those regulations, they are not something bad, but they are something good. So anyone says, oh, we don't want to prohibit this or that. But if you look, for instance, 20, 30 years ago, there were regulations saying you must not use the airports just during night. There is a quiet time from 11 in the evening to 6 o'clock in the morning. Of course, this was a regulation, and everybody's happy about that. Mm-hmm. And so whatever you regulate, this is not just against your freedom of action, but it might be just for the whole community as a very important task to reach your targets together.
Well, thank you very much for being here and for this really interesting conversation.
Thank you very much to you.
And for our audience, the 12th International Conference of the European Society for Environmental History will take place between the 22nd and the 26th of August 2023. The registration lists are still open, so of course it's a public conference, and you are most welcome to join and to take part and participate in this conference. Mm-hmm.